I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome back to the Rugby League Digest. I'm Michael Adams, here with Andrew Paskin and a very special guest, Nick Tedeschi, founder of Making the Nut. Is that correct?
Yeah, founder of Making the Nut. And look, absolute pleasure to be here, boys. It's the best podcast out there. Absolutely loved your work on the Super League War. So what an absolute pleasure it is to be invited on.
Oh, we're thrilled to have you. Your From the Couch column on Making the Nut is appointment reading for me on a Sunday night, has been for some time. Very strong opinions, very forthright opinions. You're a big Canterbury Bulldogs man, so that's why we've got you here tonight.
Yeah, absolutely. Bulldogs absolutely through and through, and that passion can sometimes turn a little narky kind of Sunday night and a weekend, another weekend of disappointment, another weekend of frustration of how the club's going. But at least today we get to look back on a much better era than what we're enduring now.
Yeah, exactly. So anyone who's not on top of From the Couch on Making the Nut, make sure you get to that. That's www.makingthenut.com.
Yeah, Nick, welcome to the podcast. We're both massive fans, as Michael said. As long as I've known Mick, he's been pushing your column. Like 7 years ago or something, I met him. He was talking about Making the Nut and From the Couch, and I got to get on it. So Mick's a lifer for you, and he's got me onto it as well.
Fantastic. And look, to be honest, there's not much money to be made out of something like Making the Nut, but the real joy has come from the kind of connections you make with this kind of rugby league underworld. that exists with, you know, you guys. I know you had Rami on the last podcast, which was tremendous. The great Albie Tallarico and a few others as well. So, look, it's been absolute pleasure to write. It's been as much therapeutic as anything, writing from the couch, as most readers can probably tell. But it's been, you know, kind of connecting up with other rugby league diehards who have, you know, created their own interesting forums and probably none better than you guys.
Well, the reason why we're getting you here tonight is because this was years before Andy and I started the Rugby League Digest. It was not long after I met him. I was like, you got to check out this guy. He writes this From the Couch column. 20 years on from Super League, he's still calling the Bulldogs for the Filthy Four.
I'll be honest, I had forgotten I had named it that until I just happened upon the podcast. On the episode. I was like, oh, I think I did do that. It was. I'll be honest with you and the listeners, it's really written in sobriety. So yeah. things do get a little crazy. But look, if anyone who's read the Guardian this week and my views on Sonny Bill Williams returning, can't hold a grudge.
So a true rugby league man.
A good operator, as they say.
So this is one of these case studies that we'll be doing over our off-season as I'm busily preparing season two. The Bulldogs, in terms of Super League, there's probably no club that Super League had more ramifications for, and they were really in the thick of it in so many ways, culminating in the Premiership in 95, which I want to get to at the end of the episode. So what I want to do tonight with you, Nick, is to basically backtrack over some of the stuff that we've talked about in terms of the Bulldogs and Super League. Before we get to that, I want to get to the heart of your rugby league story, your Bulldogs fandom. So where does it all start with you?
I'm a country kid, actually recording this from the town I grew up in, a place called Orange in central west New South Wales. loving the game from a very young age. Strangely enough, I can recall. I don't know whether this is reconstructed memory or a legit memory, but of a Saturday afternoon game, I think in about 86 or 87, and my old man goes, "Who are you going for, the blue team or the red team?" It was North against Canterbury. I chose blue, and the rest is history.
Very wise.
My rugby league fandom may have been very, very different had I chosen red that. But it was a couple of seminal moments. My best mate growing up was from a huge rugby league family. I had a couple of uncles who played a little bit of first grade footy. They were absolute diehard league guys. We were staying at a hotel, and I ran into Cliff Lyons and asked for his autograph. And he said, "Would you like the rest of the boys?" And took me around every one of their room and got an autograph from the rest of the Manly team in a preseason game. And been hooked ever since.
Group 10 there in Orange, isn't it?
Group 10, Orange Sims, is my team out here. Unfortunately, been called off this year because of COVID. But, it's been a very successful team, and it's produced some good players over the years.
I was living in Cobar back in 2006, which was the year that the mighty Cobar Roosters won the comp, taking on a previously undefeated Wellington team in the grand final. So got a lot of good memories of bush footy.
There's not much like it going out there and you know, having a pie or a hot dog and a couple of tinnies on the hill rugged up. Bush footy, there's something special about it. And I think, you know, on a probably more professional level, what Newtown have done at Henson Park and the team out there has really replicated to a probably higher level what you get, that atmosphere you get at bush footy. You get real food, you get real people and some real bloody big hits. You know, it was only recently Bubba Kennedy retired from playing out at Group 10 footy. So,
wow.
And he was around in the heyday of the Super League Wars. So, and of course, his boy is playing for Cronulla now. But you get some pretty good stories out here.
I'm not sure if you're aware, Nick, that Nick Kosef was from Cobar.
Has been mentioned in Dispatch.
Andy, you're from Toronto. You talk about the Scorpions often. Do you have the same memories of heading to the ground there?
The best thing about my memories of that ground is when it was a night game and they'd had the car lights on that people would drive into the hill and then shine the lights on the field. That was the coolest.
How good are those stories of bush footy? I know the stories of the Ma Cup back in the day.
Mm.
And you know, there was the same thing, you know. There were obviously no floodlights back then, so they'd drive the cars up to the ground, across the fields and shine them on so they could finish the game. Like that's tremendous stuff, and you know, this goes on for time immemorial.
Well, let's get to Super League itself. So 1995, the story breaks. Can you remember? Well, I guess 94 was when it first came out. Can you remember your first memories of when it started all kicking off?
I remember the front page of the Telegraph on April 1. And just being blown away. I'm pretty sure it was a Saturday, and I think I was on my way to probably junior soccer or something like that at the time, and was just completely blown away. I must have been 12 at the time, and just seeing Terry Lamb among the group of, wow, there's got to be a different league. What's this mean for footy? And completely innocently, completely naively at the time, even though I think I probably, at least in hindsight for myself, stumbled on the right place, was just like, this sounds fantastic. This is going to be so cool. I remember a big footy card collector at the time and just like, oh, all right, let's get all the Norths and Manly cards together and see what the Northern Eagles would look like. Oh, what if there was a, Wests and Canterbury and Parramatta? Oh, how cool would that be? Not really kind of thinking of it actually happening, but then obviously things got a lot uglier and clubs and people became a lot more selfish, and very, very glad that Canterbury didn't end up merging with West or Parramatta or Penrith.
That's the first person I've spoken to that had that outward look that early on. You know, like I think a lot of people are very protective of their clubs and the ramifications of a Super League, but you were excited from the get-go.
Yeah, I was excited. I was also brought up, my family not so much, but kind of the kind of people like, the fathers of the kids I associated with who were league diehards were very, very cynical about the job that Arco and Quail had been doing. It was a very pro-Manly league. Grew up on stories of Manly in the late 70s and Hollywood Hartley and all that kind of stuff. So, the influence Bozo had on the game. So I was very excited for it. But to be fair, Yeah, I'm probably getting a bit too much credit there. To be fair, had Canterbury been along with the ARL from the get-go, I may have had a very different view on that as well. So I was definitely more Canterbury than I was probably rugby league at the time. So they were on. I watched as much as we could. Yeah, yeah. Those fabulous hour-long packages on a Sunday night to capture, you know, 2 hours of footy and all that absolute rot. But I remember being excited by the concept of pay TV. I've always loved America. Grew up a big wrestling fan. So, yeah, the idea of, yeah, all these channels and all these sports being shown, and the fact that this could happen with rugby league, we get to see every game. That was such a foreign concept in 1994. And, you know, it was something that definitely excited me.
Well, Nick, I think our childhoods were very similar. Like, I got to ask you who your all-time favourite wrestlers are from the 80s and 90s.
I was a big Nature Boy Ric Flair man. I probably sided with the NWA more than the WWF. So I was a big Ric Flair fan. And on the WWF side, Ultimate Warrior. Absolutely love the Ultimate Warrior. In hindsight, probably not a good selection. Considering his politics. But and also really loved Bret the Hitman Hart.
Well, I was a big fan of those too, but I saw some independent wrestling in Newcastle in 93 and had Jim the Anvil Neidhart, Junkyard Dog, and Jake the Snake, and I touched Jake the Snake's shoulder. And I didn't realize he was probably on crack at the time. But as a kid, I was loving it.
I remember meeting the Bushwhackers at some show in Australia's Wonderland, the long forgotten Australia's Wonderland. And I could not believe how excited I was. The Bushwhackers. Unbelievable.
Isn't it funny how like Australia's Wonderland was situated in the least wondrous part of Sydney?
you didn't realise that at the time, and I recall going there after meeting the Bushwhackers, Mike, and the excitement of going meeting the Bushwhackers and then staying. It must have been at the Parramatta Best Western or somewhere out west there, and watching the Greyhounds on Sky Channel at night and ordering pizzas in the room. Wow. I could not have lived a more privileged junior lifestyle.
Love it.
Well, Nick, you've made Andy's day because he's finally got someone to talk about wrestling with, because I've got no idea. But let's move back to the topic at hand, rugby league. Before we get to Super League, let's look at Canterbury as a club. In our Bullfrog chapter, I did a real deep dive in the history of the club from when he took over in 69 onwards. And my God, what a story that organization has.
Absolutely. Yeah, even dating all the way back to the 1930s, the first year of just getting absolutely hammered. Yeah, to records that still stand to this day, winning a premiership 3 years later, another premiership 4 years after that, which is two premierships in your first 7 years, was quite remarkable, to a long, long drought. Like, this club was on its knees up to the 50s and into the 60s, to knocking off the great St. George team in 67. Ending that run, and then Bullfrog coming on, and you would struggle. Yeah, I know people will talk about Frank Facer. They'll talk about some of the Kevin Humphreys and the like. You'd struggle to find a more influential member of Clubland than you will Peter Moore.
Yeah, agreed. Because I mean, Facer has a strong argument, but he did it with four immortals in his team. What Bullfrog was able to build, it's unbelievable.
It really was, and the unique kind of outlook he took. People talk about Moneyball these days and constantly misuse the term, and this is not a fair reflection of what Moneyball is as well, but his different way of thinking of recruiting, of really attacking the country areas, of really tapping into Queensland, of really building family bonds. You know, like I was having a drink with Peter Mortimer on Sunday, last Sunday, at his winery out here in Orange. And he was telling the story about how Canterbury came out to play a preseason game against a team in the Riverina, and the starting halfback was out, and they played a 17-year-old kid, redhead, called Steve Mortimer. And Bullfrog was so impressed that he's gone, he will never play against Canterbury again. And then got him and his brothers down there. And yeah, they're still the backbone of the club. Peter's on the board these days. So his legacy lives on, of course. His son, of course, coach, plus a couple of son-in-laws. His daughter is chairman of the club. This lives on and will live on for a long time, yeah.
The crazy thing about it is there's, you know, we talk about the family club and, you know, cries of nepotism and all the rest of it. But so much success came out of this nepotism.
Absolutely. Like, I, that was one of the things as a kid. I really loved it. They'd really built this identity. Like, it was nepotism, but it wasn't unique to Canterbury. He just did it well. to be fair, like, he, you know, don't get me wrong, you look at what Bob Fulton did with his boys at Manly. Yeah, not to the same level of installing him as coach, but I'm sure, yeah, had they been a bit more successful, he may have. Yeah, so it's he just did such a remarkable job. And, yeah, to this day I find it incredible that, yeah, he just reminds me of an old-school Labor politician, rough and ready, and you wonder how they engender this kind of loyalty. And don't get me wrong, he used the stick as much as the carrot to kind of get that along, but people love Bullfrog. And he just created this winning culture that was lasted for such a long period of time. Like, the success, not just in the 80s, through two pretty distinct phases, the, you know, the entertainers to the Warren Ryan era, but then to kick again in the mid-90s, make a grand final, win another, make one in 98, and even in through the early 2000s. That's very much the legacy of Peter Moore.
To have five successive coaches win premierships, like, that's, I haven't looked into it, but I'm sure that's got to be the only time that that's happened.
Oh, absolutely. They always say that yeah, you don't want to be the guy who follows the guy. Well, it was the guy who followed the guy who followed the guy who followed the guy kept winning premierships.
Yeah,
and he was pretty ruthless. Like, you know, he did go and recruit Phil Gould to come in 88, and once he'd had enough of Phil, like, it's pretty hard to sack a coach, yeah, a year from a premiership. But yeah, he was ruthless with Warren Ryan. Yeah, the only people he probably wasn't that ruthless with was his family. So, as a diehard Chris Anderson man, I'm very glad that was the case.
Well, I mean, if you compare the Parramatta, everyone looks at the 80s Parra versus Canterbury. Parra petered out in 87, and then Canterbury went through, like you said, the early 2000s. It's incredible longevity of success.
Yeah, absolutely. My memories of Parramatta, 88 is probably the first season I probably truly remember. Well, Parramatta were an absolute joke by that side. I remember them getting absolutely trounced in Canberra one day. Sterling was always out, hurt. I know I think he won the Rothmans in 89, but Kenny was in his... No, my grandfather was a very passionate Parramatta man, but the days of Cronin and Price were long gone. They just didn't have that second wave that Canterbury really did.
I always have this theory about rugby league clubs. Like, how much of it is just luck of juniors? Like, you know, Canberra gets Brad Clyde and Laurie Daly coming through, and, you know, Mullins and what have you. And Canberra had the Mortimer brothers poached from the country. You know, it just seems like you have to get very lucky with your juniors.
I think so. That's probably particularly more so in the salary cap. I think it's a combination of probably either getting lucky or kind of recruiting young well, but also having a good coach, a good head coach. If you put the Mortimers and whatnot under Tommy Radonikis, for example, in the 90s, I don't think that's going to mean. I don't think that's going to mean too much. Yeah, I think Canterbury were blessed. If Peter Moore had one great skill outside of the recruitment thing, it was his ability to identify a good coach, and he also had the confidence in himself that he would hire people he did not like. Like, there's not a person around who would say a bad word about Ted Glossop, but there aren't too many people around who would say a good word about Warren Ryan either. Or feel good for that matter, and he endured them both for the good of the club. So,
well, there's two people here who'll say something good about Warren Ryan.
Yeah, he also pinched about five Canterbury players in the early 90s as well when he went to West. So, there was definitely a fair bit of dislike for West from the Canterbury point of view in the early 90s, particularly in that famous playoff in 91 where Canterbury lost 19-14. But in my memory, I'm sure, has probably exacerbated this. But Jonathan Davies was definitely through a hole when all the West fans come steaming on, and Bill Harrigan called full time without Davies being tackled. So still filthy on that. Still filthy on the what?
To be fair, I think you guys had enough success in that era. But I want to go back to Warren Ryan. He is an endless source of fascination for Andrew and I. When we were putting together our Bullfrog chapter, I had to cut out like literally hours worth of content, like stories of feuds, you know, the big feud with Mortimer, the feud with Bullfrog, a spying scandal involving Phil Gould. Like, no one man in rugby league has generated so much joy to me in my project of researching rugby league history.
And it hasn't stopped. He's belting other old blokes at the top of the eastern suburbs to this day. So, yeah, there is something about Warren Ryan that is just endlessly fascinating. And I think one story that sums up well is I can't think of too many coaches who would have played Greg Smith in 1999 for Newcastle. Just on the story that he played for the Philadelphia Eagles. Like, sure, the internet wasn't where it is today and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, the walk was just like it was a little bit of Jack Gibson about him without the personability. It kind of took bits of Jack, bits of Brian Smith, and but you can't argue with it. I don't think there were Newtown had more success under Warren Ryan than anyone else. Canterbury absolutely up there with that. And the last kind of flailing days of Wests and Balmain, their last kind of successful eras were both under Warren Ryan.
Well, it's funny, Nick, because like we correspond with our listeners like regularly, and we get probably a story a week from someone whose mum worked with him or someone who knew him, and every single story is just berating some stranger he's just met.
I think there's just something in there that his ability to hate is peak rugby league. And someone like that doesn't survive in this game if they can't hate to his level. And I don't know that too many people in rugby league could hate like Warren Ryan hate.
I just want to. I wish I could go back and be in a dressing room to watch him coach, because he did have his defenders. He has defenders to this day. But the general consensus is he was the biggest prick I've ever met. But I've never seen a better coach. And I don't know how you can strike that balance and have that dynamic when so much of coaching is about personability and man management. But he seems to go the complete opposite way.
His ability on the X's and O's must have been something else. It really must have been his insight into how rugby league is played and should be played must have truly been something else. And obviously was ahead of its time. But for him to engender, to this day, like you say, people will say he's the one of the best coaches of all time. It's quite incredible.
But is it like in coaching rugby league in particular, is it not about authenticity? So if he goes, I'm a prick and I'm going to own it, so they go, well, he's a prick, so we have to listen to him because he's being honest.
I'll see if that works for Anthony Seabold. I think there is something there. I think there is something there, though. I think, you do see a lot of angry coaches and fire coaches. I think at its core, What will engender more loyalty than anything else in rugby league is the genuine belief that this guy will make me better as a footballer, which in itself will this guy will earn me more money. This guy will this guy will get me state of origin jerseys, Australian jerseys. This guy will help me win a premiership. I don't think anywhere he went, people did not believe that.
Another divisive figure, nowhere near walk level, but Chris Anderson himself seems a funny type of personality, but you're a massive defender, big fan of Chris Anderson. Can you talk a bit on your feelings about Chris Anderson?
I absolutely love Chris Anderson, and I like Chris Anderson when he came on. I like what he did with the Bulldogs. We went through a couple of dark years in the 89-90, kind of got us on the up and up. And to be fair, this was, everyone looks back on the time they were 12 was the greatest time in X sport and in rugby league. That was my sport, and Chris Anderson was the man, and then taking us to that premiership. But his vindictiveness and pettiness to drop Jarrod McCracken the year before he did the same to Darren Smith
in reserve
grade. Like, I love that. And it's like, this is a guy, you're either with us or against us, and if you're against us, you can bugger off to reserve grade. I want nothing to do with you. And but when he kicked Jarrod McCracken off the bus for whinging or carrying on or wanting to stop somewhere, I absolutely love that. He brought about success. He was a pretty unassuming kind of character. I was too young to remember his playing days, but a pretty dry, unassuming kind of guy. And he was Canterbury growing up. For me growing up, Terry Lamb and Chris Anderson were Canterbury. I stuck with defending him through the storm, which was easy, Sharks fans not so fond, and the one marker at the Roosters really kind of drove it. it was tough to defend, but I absolutely love Chris Evans. I think he's I would go as far as saying one of the most underrated coaches, at least that I've seen in the last 30 years. Not many coaches can get premierships at two different clubs, and he probably took Cronulla to as good as they've done in a long time as well. So I think he's was a very clever coach back in his days, but unfortunately, by the time he got to the Roosters, the game had passed him by.
I was a huge fan at the Storm, but the flat attack was ahead of its time and it was genius. But then by the time we got to Cronulla, like the flat attack was so flat it was almost forward, and it was and the game had passed him by even at Cronulla. But I mean, it sort of happens in style of play, doesn't it? So you can't really knock him for that. But he's easily the most successful coach that resembles Dracula.
Wasn't renowned for his excitable personality, but you've got to talk about Warren Ryan's authenticity. Yeah, Opes was what Opes was, and he was a pretty big believer at Canterbury. His belief was get a pack that is monstrous and a couple of clever halves. That's what you need for success. And built a team, and we'll get to 95, I'm sure, soon. But yeah, at its core, the 95 team was built around a massive pack. And Terry Lamb and Jim Dimmick being able to kind of create points.
How do you feel? Obviously, Canterbury aren't in a particularly good position. How do you feel about the job Chris and Lynn have done since the reform ticket?
I had a lot of hope when they came on board. I think that, it's probably been disappointing so far. But I am happy to kind of let them keep on keeping on if they can kind of start moving some stuff in the right direction. I think they've found themselves with a pretty divided board and a pretty divided club. And I think they were completely hamstrung by what Raylene and Des left them. So I didn't like the hiring of Dean Pay at the start for many reasons. One, he couldn't coach, and two, he was part of the Filthy Four. To my dying day, I find it completely unforgivable that two of the Filthy Four have gone on to coach Canterbury. So very disappointing. I think they could do a better job. I think they need to probably surround themselves with fewer ex-players and try to get a few more astute operators, because the footy that they grew up and knew and succeeded at is long gone.
They were like handed a terrible situation, but it seems that any decision that's been made in the last couple of years is a complete head scratcher. So I don't know.
Yeah, I think the recruitment's been a shambles, to be honest. I understand that we are fairly limited in what we can do and who we can afford, but then you're going to spend money on someone like a Christian Crichton, a Joe Stimson. We have 1,000 boring slow back rowers. We don't need 1,001. And then all of a sudden, here comes Dean Brick. Yeah, got the famous last name. Give him another deal. So I'm hopeful that with a bit of clear space that, and even though I've made my feelings pretty clear, I don't think the Trent Barrett experiment is going to be a success. I would like to at least think that with his standing in the game as a player and a supposed attacking guru, that he will be able to attract some modicum of talent that has been missing. Because on a pure talent-for-talent basis, this Canterbury side would have to rank in the top 10 least talented sides of the NRL era.
Absolutely. I mean, like, if Trent Barrett can't improve with a full cap from what they are now, the guy, like, cannot coach. So, I mean, it has to go up from here.
There's not too far down from here. There's not too far down. Like, it's been... It was disappointing for me as a kid if we missed the finals 1 year, and to be in the state we're in now, like, it just seems forever ago since we played finals, and it seems like forever still we will play finals. And I understand that the business of footy's changed, and the probably lowers are low and takes a bit longer to get back to the top of the tree, but gosh, it's been a long time. I think since the Dogs last won a premiership, the Cowboys, the West Tigers, Cronulla, of all one premiership, so it's pretty sick.
And what the club has lost in that time is, you could have your lean years here and there, but Canterbury had the reputation as a great club. Whatever was going on the field, you had the endorsement of the top coaches in the game. I remember an interview with Mick Ennis, and he was talking about leaving the Broncos, not knowing where he was going to go. Wayne Bennett actually wanted to get him to come to the Dragons, but he didn't really want to go back to the Dragons. And Wayne Bennett suggested the Bulldogs and said, they're a good club. Phil Gould, same thing, you know, saying to Brad Fittler that the Bulldogs are one of the few clubs a player of your stature should consider going to. So it seems, call it, you know, Bulldogs DNA, Bullfrogs legacy, whatever it is, for the longest time, they had this reputation, and it seems to have gone so dramatically south so quickly.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd say that probably even lasted to being able to draw Des Hasler to kind of refresh off winning a premiership. I think, you know, like drawing a good coach was not really a problem. I know he has Steve Folks for a long time and then tried Kevin Moore. But I think I had Steve Folks left and the Bulldogs had a chase to Wayne Bennett or someone of that ilk. There would have been a chance of being able to pull that off. These days, that's laughable. I don't think Wayne Bennett would suggest Canterbury in the top five clubs in Sydney that you would want to send your kid to. You would want to send a talented player to. But the way they've misused players, Mocklehouse is a great example. We ditch him. He goes and wins a premiership with Cronulla for Michael Leisha in pretty much a swap. Leisha must have the slowest pass of all time around. Canterbury desperately crying out for season players, lose Ennis, then lose Reynolds, James Graham, who wouldn't have been asking for much cash. Players like David Clemmer, you understand, but yeah, I grew up on the likes of Steve Reardon, Robert Ralph, Tony Grimaldi, Brad Moran, these hardened season veterans who were never the most talented types, but have worked their backsides off and really set the example for the club, set the example of what you need to do to be successful. And that's just gone. That is so long, that is so far out of Canterbury's DNA. Yeah, that's what Melbourne's DNA is now. That's not what Canterbury's DNA is.
But so much of it is in the salary cap era is one bad signing can hamstring you. Like the Michael Leisha situation, diabolical, and Damien Cook.
Don't start me on the Damien.
Kieran Foran on $1 million, you know, perpetually injured. I mean, he isn't half the player he was, that type of thing. It's like, it happened with Brisbane with Jack Bird. If you tie up $1 million in a player that's ineffective, I think you're basically gone.
Absolutely. If you tie up $1 million with anyone that's not named Cameron Smith, it looks like you're gone based on that top 100 list. If you go through that top 100 list of highest paid players in the game that the Telegraph published not that long ago, in the top 10, there would be maybe one or two of the actual top 10 players in the game being paid that much.
Yeah,
you've got Ben Hunt and Kieran Foran and the like, and you're up, they're just hamstring clubs. And yeah, on one level, that's why the NRL is great. Like, you know, for most reasons, clubs can win quickly, but without a draft, it's very hard to bounce back from being very bad if you've got someone on a long-term deal that you cannot get rid of.
The Broncos with Milford and Bird, that's literally half your cap just sitting in reserve grade, basically.
Oh, they'd be better off if they were sitting in reserve grade the way they've played over the last couple of years.
That's the one thing I hope the Bulldogs get at the end of this season is not the spoon, because watching the Broncos the last few weeks, I've just been, how is this team not coming last? So I'm hoping that corrects itself sooner rather than later.
Well, if Dean Pay was still the coach, we would have thrived, because all his wins seemed to come in the final third of the season when the year was long gone. Yeah. So that would have been handy. Look, so do I. I think Canterbury, for the most part, have really dug in. They're just so bereft of talent that they are incapable of matching a lot of those teams. But yeah, I could count on a couple of fingers the times they've thrown the towel in this year. So I don't think they deserve the last place spot. I think the Brisbane Broncos definitely do it for the enjoyment that Anthony Seibold has given the public this year. It would be a fitting honour.
Can I just ask, Nick, is there a culture issue at the Dogs at the moment? Like, you see all the Adam Elliott incidents and the, you know, there's a few whispers coming out of Canterbury here and there where it never used to be. Has it become a party club, you think?
I'm not sure it's a party club. I think it's maybe more a club stuck in the past. You know, kind of that old uncle who tells bawdy stories at inappropriate times and says inappropriate things at the Christmas table. Like, I think there's a lack of modernity in the club. I think they don't really know what they want to be. I think they're actually lacking a strong leader from either a coach or a player to actually define what the club is. So I think that right. there's just a lot of... Because, you know, what Adam Elliott did wasn't a great look, wasn't the end of the world. But it's not what Canterbury should be. And it's not what, you know, we should be doing. And combined with a lot of the stuff that went on, you know, at Port Macquarie and a lot of the other stuff. Like, yeah, you know, I remember speaking with Lynn Anson a few years ago, and her view was that the club should be very wary of signing bad people is the wrong term, but signing people with potential issues and the like. Well, then we go and sign Corey Harawira-Naira, who was very much caught up in some of the Penrith stuff that went on out there, is now being released for the Bulldogs. If you want to create a good culture, you don't go signing players like that. Especially when you've got salary cap troubles. Like, you just don't go signing players like that. Full stop.
I'm actually happy that Canberra got him, because usually Canberra loses a player to a scandal, but we're actually picking up a good player. But what was the issue there? Like, he was angry at how Canterbury treated him after the schoolgirl thing. Is that what happened?
Yeah, that's what's happened. And I'm not entirely sure everything's come out on that story either. But I think it's a little high and mighty to be suggest you've been hardly done by.
That's what I mean. The audacity of it.
Well, that's probably a good place to get back to the past, because the success of 95 was in many ways built on a culture of no layers that was really developed in the 1980s. I want to finish on a positive, so we might save the general 95 talk to the end. Let's dig into the filthy four now. So can you put your rage, your anger, your bitterness into words, Nick?
I go back to one story I don't know if it would be that acceptable now, but I just feel me with such pride at the time, and to this day still fills me with such pride. But it must have been midway through the 95 season. Maybe it was 96 after they'd left. Canterbury fans stood on the hill and burnt Jared McCracken's book. It must have been 90. It must have been 96.
It was 96,
because it was called A Family Betrayal. And they set it alight, I think. Wow, I wish I was there that day, because that was something special. For some reason, McCracken has always stood out as the guy I've hated the most of the Filthy Four. He had a sense of entitlement and arrogance that I just could not cop. And you saw the likes of Dimmick and Dean Payne, and to a point lesser extent, Jason Smith, kind of get some redemption at the back end of the season. I just kind of always felt Jared McCracken was the ringleader there. He was a troublemaker from the get-go. I remember he was out for 8 weeks for eye gouging a couple of years prior. I think he was trouble from the get-go. And I think he would have taken the rest of them for a fair ride. And I know that the likes of Gould and Bozo and the like got their claws stuck into the Filthy Four. But I dare say Jared McCracken was the one who took them to the lair. So it's... there was so much disappointment with that, because they were probably four of our probably six, seven best players. Terry Lamb was retiring. I went to his final game in the 95, final game of the regular season, 95, a farewell to the bar. They knocked off the Cowboys 6-4. One of the great memories of my childhood. They absolutely ran right on the Cowboys that day. Terry Lamb got a couple. And then Terry Lamb having to come out of retirement in 96 on a pretty fruitless campaign that was never much hope of succeeding. And have to have those memories of farewell game, lifting the trophy, sullied because of these four traitors, unforgivable.
And what was annoying is that at the time, they didn't realise what was going on with Terry Lamb coming back. They were calling it this lineage of ill-advised comebacks, like he should have stayed retired, not realising that it wasn't his choice. He had the fairy tale ending, but he's just that much of a clubman that he knew that he was needed.
Yeah, he absolutely, and I've spoken to Terry about this, he absolutely did not want to come back for 96. He was talked into it by Chris Anderson and Peter Moore. And you can't blame, like I said, he's a great clubman to come back. This wasn't a Muhammad Ali coming out of retirement, one of those situations. This is Terry Lamb doing what was right for the club. And the club was cast, because by the time the court cases were settled, there wasn't a lot of players on the market for the Bulldogs to be able to go and recruit, and it was a pretty ordinary season, 96, and not the way Terry Lamb should have gone out.
This is stepping on our 96, our next season, but to me, the thing that sums it all up is he has this fairy tale finish, goes out a winner, has to come back. His last game, played before about 6,000 at Belmore, absolutely pissing down. The Dogs get the win, but, you know, it's a lost season. It wasn't, you know, the same as the year before. The club was going to honour him with a train going past, stopping with a sign that said, you know, congratulations, bar, whatever it was going to say. The train was running late, so by the time it arrived, they were already back in the dressing room.
Very rugby league.
Oh, that is very rugby league. I absolutely love that. It's probably wouldn't happen these days with PVL, the man who makes the train. But back in 96, it was a different time. I hated that he had to come back like that. Yeah, I just was such a Terry Lamb fan. And what he did for not only the club, but my love of rugby league and my favourite memories of watching footy as a kid was Terry Lamb. And for him to have to come back and play with, you know, a pretty ragtag bunch. There was, you know, there's some good kids coming through, but they weren't ready yet to lose all that star power. And it was so deflating. And like I say, after he not only lifted the trophy, but, yeah, we'll get to it, but one of the most famous finals runs of all time. Yeah, that 66-4 win in the final round of the year. Like, it was a fairy tale finish for Terry Lamb. And then, yeah, so to go out on a miserable day at Belmore, not ideal.
We might as well keep talking about Terry Lamb at this point because it's definitely something I wanted to touch on. I hated Canterbury. They were my least favourite team in the comp at that point. It goes back to 88. I fell in love with Ellery Hanley, and we all know how that ended. Going to high school, there was a big Dragons versus Dogs rivalry, so I hated the Dogs. I hated Terry Lamb. And now I've come to really respect the Dogs and Terry Lamb in particular. I kind of wish I could go back and watch him again with adult eyes.
Yeah, it's funny that. I find it hard to separate as well because we all know how Ellery Hanley did headbutt Terry Lamb's fist viciously in the 88 grand final. It is hard. I find it very hard to probably appreciate him as an adult. Like, every time I see a highlight, it's just this giddy, 10, 12, 14-year-old who just love the Bulldogs through blue and white eyes. I've certainly had the same view of other players. I definitely didn't appreciate, say, a Brad Clyde at the time as much as I would now. And almost certainly didn't appreciate those kind of workhorse forwards that were in and around the club at the time, but he was such a phenomenal, phenomenal player. And what I not particularly, he just seemed to get everything out of his talent. Yeah, he definitely did not. Yeah, it's almost like a Stephen Mark War situation with him and say Brett Kenny. Brett Kenny looked amazing, and of course was an amazing player. Had that grace that Mark War did. Terry Lamb just dug in. He backed up everywhere. He could kick goals. He kicked field goals even when you didn't need him. Yeah, he was. Everywhere, doing everything, and try scoring machine for a half, total rarity. It was leadership. He would just get the most out of the team. We'll just absolutely dig in, but always seemed so approachable. I remember meeting Terry Lamb as a kid and thinking, this guy is just one of the greatest humans of all time. And it was, sometimes you meet your heroes when you're a kid and they disappoint you. I remember meeting Dean Jones once, who was my favourite cricketer and was one of the rudest SOBs I've ever had at the time, I thought, I'm just a kid, go about an autograph, wouldn't come out at a Sheffield Shield game for 2 days. But Terry Lamb put his arm around you, take a photo, talk to you, all that kind of stuff. Wonderful, wonderful player, wonderful person.
Well, we were talking off air, Nick, about your miniature schnauzer. Like, that's how I always felt about Terry Lamb. He looks like one of those small dogs with the small legs, but real fast. And
full of heart and just kept on going. It's like... Yeah, a bit like the Energizer Bunny as well. Like, he just kept on keeping on. And even not all the people, but I guess he's probably pretty well known by this stage, actually, that he didn't train much by the end. Yeah, he was well and truly fond of a drink. He didn't mind a dart. Yeah, you don't have to go back to how he encapsulated his career. He debuted when Winfield came on and he was finishing up in the final year of the Winfield Cup. Yeah, he based his he bookended his career around cigarettes. So he wasn't renowned for his what you call an elite athlete. Just got everything out of it. Got everything. Like, he made everyone around him better. Like, they would do that team in the early 90s when he reached his stature and the greats of like your Steve Mortimer's that have moved on, they would do anything for Terry Lamb. Like that, like you, Jason Smith, Dean Pace, Simon Gillies, Jason Hetherington, yeah, all of them, they would do absolutely anything for Terry Lamb. He just made them all better players.
And that's the mark of a great footballer. If you make people around you better, like Mal, Laurie Daly, Terry Lamb, you know, there's a certain elite bunch.
Absolutely. I think his game translates to any era as well. He would have dominated in the era before the yeah, there was a 5 meter rule. I think he'd still go well now. I see a lot of similarities with Cameron Smith in his game. Obviously not at that elite level and the number of touches, but just his ability to not do anything wrong. I can't remember a Terry Lamb era. Like, I'm sure there were plenty, but he really made a
certain field goal or
yeah, other than kicking a field goal when they were down by two.
I think Peter Moore said the worst I ever saw him play was good.
Yeah, and I believe that. I would believe that. Bullfrog obviously saw every game, but he just never put in a bad game. It was weak, and he could be playing with the superstars of, you know, say 85, 86, a really good run in 95, or the battlers in 96, or the struggles of 89. Terry Lamb was still great.
Andy, I've got to step in and congratulate you on your restraint after hearing Nick's Dean Jones story to not bring up Ricky Stewart not signing your footy cards for the millionth time.
I think that's been told enough.
It's been to see you, Andy. I went to Bruce Stadium. My brother's a Raiders fan when I was a kid. He didn't sign mine either. So there's nothing personal.
Well, I mean, I've already let out the fact that Nick Kosef was from Cobar.
So turning to the rest of the team, you've already mentioned some of my favourites of that era. Jason Hetherington, like, absolute standout. I think he's a criminally underrated player. Who were some of your favourites in that team?
I was a big Craig Polamalu fan. Absolutely loved him. He kind of reminded me of Terry Lamb light. Absolutely loved him. And he kind of probably got his due a bit later on, but I was a big Craig Polamalu fan. I absolutely loved Darrell Halligan. Everything about Darrell Halligan, kicking from the sideline every which way, wonderful. And Simon Gillies was another favourite of mine. I really loved. And he played the football of his life during that final series in 95. And of course, he was captain for much of that year, Simon Gillies. So and took over for Terry Lamb's retirement. I think maybe even captain in 96. So he was just such a fierce player. And I loved everything about him. And probably the last one, probably keen to mention, Matt Ryan.
Yeah,
I absolutely loved him, the boy from Moree. There was less than no frills about him. Yeah. He had negative frills, but he was just such a try and so adaptable. You could put him at fullback if there was an injury, stick him on a wing, and finally got his due during the Super League season when he got to play a bit of rep footy. But wonderful player, Matty Ryan.
I've been amazed watching him over the course of researching this season. Like he was brilliant. Anytime I saw him play, he was one of the players that really stood out. And from having like little memory of him as a player, apart from the name, I'm like, wow, Matt Ryan is really good.
He was outstanding, and he had a great fend on him, plenty of speed, had that old man elusiveness. You know, could just move the hips in and get on the outside of someone and get around him. Little offload, you kind of don't see a lot of centres like him these days. But there's more than a bit of Matt Gidley about the way he played footy, Matt Ryan, and he's you're right, criminally underrated. But it was great to see him play for the New South Wales team in '97.
Well, all those players you mentioned there, Nick, I think they all speak to your love of the Canterbury culture, because all those guys were killer clubmen.
Yeah, absolutely. My favourites over the years going from those guys, but yeah, Tony Grimaldi, Steve Reardon, yeah, all these just, yeah, Andrew Ryan, Luke Patton, just pure club men who would just give their all. And I know there's something about, yeah, we've talked about the Filthy Four, and probably I've carried that grudge on probably longer than anyone at Canterbury, including everyone at the club. But it's something about loyalty that is ingrained in Canterbury that I think. Yeah, I've always loved and prided about being part of the Bulldogs. Yeah, I know they weren't always local juniors that come through, but players that played for Canterbury, particularly in that era, come and played for a long time. We weren't recruiting them maybe at their best. Yeah, we weren't kind of going out and buying players at their peak. We'd get Terry Lamb. Yeah, sure, yeah, he was flying at West, but there's still better yet to come. Yeah, we kind of go and pick up like a Mark Brokenshire from Manly. You could build a club around and all that kind of stuff. So Mark Sargent, was there as well. So it's just really love that as part of the Bulldogs DNA. And sadly, you'd struggle to find too many outside of probably Adam Elliott and Josh Jackson in that mould these days.
Well, I was speaking to the boys on the Joust Newcastle podcast about Polamalu last week, and I suggested that there's a reincarnation in the modern game, Cody Nikorima.
Yeah. If Cody Nikorima played for a good side, you'd probably say something out of that. I think that's a very fair assessment. He just went a million miles an hour, Polamalu. I'm sure this is incorrect, but he seemed to have the smallest legs of anyone who's ever played rugby league.
Well, those halves, I mean, like the center of gravity was at the Earth's core for those two.
You're not wrong there. And I must have been early 2000s. There was talk of a Craig Polamalu comeback. And it made the papers. And my excitement levels were through the roof. It was unfortunately aborted, but absolutely love Polly. He was brilliant. He gave it all. I don't think he played Origin, but he was definitely mentioned.
He was always talked about, yeah.
Of who's he eligible for? Is he a Queenslander? Is he a New South Welshman? There was talk he might have played hooker for Queensland, I think, at one stage, but I don't think he ever got the call.
I think he was in a bad era for quality halfbacks, but in a different era, he might have got the nod, like the John Simon role or something like that.
Absolutely. There's too much question that he probably would have been a better half and definitely better suited to Origin than John Simon. But, he did come around in an era of great, great halfbacks. And then, had he have not signed with Super League, before the kind of, he could easily have played that Jeff Toobey role. Probably not to the same level, but had there been any injuries.
So let's get to the final series, because me and Andy getting ready for our 95 recap, I was just enthralled at every game I watched during that series, not just the Dogs games, but that's got to be one. The grand final may be a little bit flat, but that final series, that's got to be up there with some of the best series of all time.
Oh, absolutely. It was a tremendous series. And I can remember the 95 series. I struggle to remember what I had for lunch today. Can remember the 95 series. Yeah, it's just ingrained in my memory as just the absolute highlight of my life. Like it was, just random tidbits. Like I remember having a $2 bet with my mate's mum. His dad was an SP bookie and would not let me on at the 33s at the start of the final series. And she goes, "I'll bet you she was a Saints fan." It went double or nothing throughout the whole final series. I thought, how good is this 16 bucks? This is unbelievable. And going over and gloating about it as Pete Boss, my mate's old man, slowly went away and closed the window. And I only found it years later. He'd laid the 33s over the gap, and it was a horrid result for the Boss family. The Dogs were going to win it, but I just remember the rain at the football stadium in that St George game. I think it was Robert Relf may have laid one on Gordon Tallis in the scrum. He definitely laid it on someone. It's Terry Lamb getting sent to the sin bin for the first time. That final series. I think it was Mundine knocked the ball on over the line.
Yes. 1 minute into the game.
Yeah, 1 minute into the game.
Yeah. Brought up some PTSD watching that game again. That was a tough one.
I think it was a John Teamer who crashed over for the Dogs.
Yeah.
It was a pretty dubious try as well. May have been a shepherd in that, but play on. It was a wonderful game. And I definitely didn't know that they were a team of destiny then, but gee, you felt something. You just really felt, because the Dogs were massive outsiders in every game they played that final series. They were huge outsiders, like particularly against the Raiders in the prelim, and even the Broncos. They were huge outsiders, and just got the job done. Like I struggled to recall a more complete performance in a preliminary final, but the number of the Bulldogs did on the Raiders. Winning 25-6, Simon Gillies, a couple of tries. I think Albert Fuller, I had a shocker for the Raiders. But it was, like, the Raiders had lost not many games all year.
I think it was two, wasn't it?
Two games all year, and we're monster favourites. Like, this is one of the great teams of all time. They had all the big guns there. And but absolutely, Bill, I don't recall the Raiders being in the game. Simon Gillie's got a double that day. Just a wonderful performance. And one of my memories of the finals that year was just how overcast it was in Sydney during those finals games.
Mm.
Like I think there might have been some sun in the Broncos game, but that St. George game and the Raiders game, definitely overcast, definitely wet.
And funnily enough, it was in many ways on the back of three of the filthy four that you got the job done. Dean Payne in that St. George game was amazing, going toe-to-toe with Gordon Tallis and then setting up the winning try.
Yeah.
Jim Dimmick in the grand final. So it goes back to what we said at the start of the episode about Canterbury thriving in this dysfunctional situation. Like, this is the ultimate example of that.
Absolutely. They were, backs against the wall, dogs of war mentality. And look, no doubt that three of the filthy four definitely played a role, but I don't know that any were as helpful in that final series as Eddie Ward was. he was helpful in that St. George game. He was helpful all the way to Great Eddie Ward. So he had a big run through it. But my memory of that final series around, I don't recall Jason Smith there. I remember Pay and Dimmick were huge. Dimmick was absolutely immense in that grand final. But just what Simon Gillies did, he just was running like a man possessed. Except every time he touched the ball, he was making a line break. I don't recall Simon Gillies making a line break in the 10 subsequent years, in the 10 years prior, or the 10 years after. Like, it was an absolute rarity. And I think Darren, from memory, Darren Britt was very good that series too.
It's funny, in my memory, Darren Britt, Steve Reid, and Robert Ralph, like, these could all be the same person, you know?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
They're just big country guys who are raw bone, made of steel, tried their guts out. They're all the same player.
I mean, how valuable is raw boneness in rugby league? It's one of the most valuable traits you can have.
Absolutely. I don't recall, a bit like the good Melbourne Storm players now, or over the last kind of 15 years, the good Bulldogs players, that they just didn't seem to get injured. They just seem to be tough and just come out every week. I don't recall Jason Hetherington getting hurt. I don't recall Darren Britt missing too much time. I know he had a few knee issues, but these were just big, hulking blokes. And it goes back to what Chris Anson tried to build. They're the kind of players he tried to build around. He tried to lay a platform. That probably culminated in the 2000 Broncos side, who very much run that, let's have a bunch of monsters with some talented backs. But Chris Anderson was very much a proponent of that. And sometimes it works. Sometimes you've got Mitch Newton. You take what you can get.
So going into the grand final, had you got the sense of team of destiny by that point?
Absolutely. I did not believe Canterbury could lose that grand final. I was absolutely... A week has never gone slower. I remember getting absolutely abused by my mum because I'd put blue and white streamers on the car window, on the side window of the car, and it had got ripped off. And she was filthy at me. I was just like, it's the dogs. Dogs are in the grand final. I'm sorry, it had to be done. And she forgave me. But it was, I truly believed after that Raiders win, no one could play better football than us. And I don't recall a lot from what Manly had done leading up to it, but I don't recall them being super impressive, and I definitely thought they may have been over the top. Not losing too many. That was, I don't know if you remember, this was very much the kind of thinking at the time was you had to lose one to win one before you could win one. You had to lose a few games. It was good for you to lose a game leading into the finals and all that kind of stuff, which I don't really believe that you don't hear much of these days, but that was definitely the kind of thinking at the time. Well, the Dogs had lost the 94 grand final. We'd really battened down the hatches. We'd gone on this run. I just thought, there's no way we can lose this. And this is the weirdest thing to believe. But when Terry Lamb got sent to the sin bin, I knew it was our day. Because that was dead set. They were going to score a try. He's given away one of the great professional fouls. Goes to the bin. The dog, Manly take the two. The Dogs give up nothing. I just think, this is us. This is us.
I feel this is something I remember, and it's not something I've just made up. As he was going off, like, you could see him talking to the team, and there was just this intent in his face, and I think you're right.
I think it may have been the slowest walk-off as well from memory. I've got a real forerunner to the modern-day player going for the Sydney. There was no, he wasn't moving at any great pace, Terry Lamb, and just calmed him down. And I might be wrong on this as well, but I do recall him kind of lifting his hands up and putting him down, like, calm down. So that may be a false memory there, but I just thought that was such a pivotal moment. And then, like, the Canterbury to lead at half time. Yeah, Manly, I know I said now that they were the team of destiny. I truly believe that going into the game. At about 30 minutes, when it was just relentless Manly, it felt, I wasn't as confident as maybe I was pre-game. So, but then when they got that try around the corner pass, that looked flat, that's still flat to me, but to go in with the lead, amazing stuff.
So where does that Canterbury team rate for you among your, life of supporting them?
There's none better. Like that 95 team in the final series was my absolute favourite. I would have been 13, nearly 14 at the time. Like, I was beyond just a kid who'd kind of come in or out of watching footy. I was watching the Dogs every time they'd played. I was collecting rugby league week. Had plenty of footy car, all that kind of stuff. I was just besotted by the game, and probably still had a little bit of innocence before the Super League war really. I kind of developed a hate, but it probably wasn't the game wasn't corporatized to the point it is today. Where you never talked about who the football manager was. You never talked about what the front office was doing. Or who you just read in the paper one day. Oh, the Dogs have signed Dale Halligan. How good's that? Oh, we've lost David Gillespie. That's no good. I absolutely love that team. I saw outside of the Filthy Four, there wouldn't be too many players in that team I wouldn't have fond memories of. I just think back to players I probably never thought much of before or since, like Rod Silver. I just absolutely loved Rod Silver that year.
Great final series.
Great finals. Great in the grand final. It was just a really special team. It was... the last grand final team coached by Chris Anderson. He went to Melbourne in 98, which was a tough pill to swallow. Probably never had the same attachment for Steve Folkes. And after that, there were too many Hughes boys running around. We started kind of developing the kind of team that would become that 2002 Coffs Harbour team, where it wasn't overly likable. Side then, and then kind of that steady downhill run through the Sonny Bill Williams, that wooden spoon run. The other team that would really probably compete with it is probably that 2009 Bulldogs. I really loved, like, when we just got a new, it was a new beginning. Mick Ennis, David Stagg, Josh Morris, Brett Camorley. It was just something special. And Kevin Moore taking over as coach, and I just absolutely loved that year. And lost that preliminary final to Parramatta. It was a bit of a pill to swallow, but I love that 95 side. They were great. I think I mentioned earlier, I was at the ground. It was my first trip to Belmore, up from the bush, to watch Terry Lamb's last home game at Belmore, which we all thought it was. And to see them win 66-4, met Terry Lamb that day. Still got a signed T-shirt somewhere from the farewell that day. And just watch them absolutely run rampant on the poor old cows. It was such a special team, and the last great swan song of Terry Lamb, and seeing him lift that trophy was wonderful.
It's hard not to be moved by that run, whoever you go for. So that's probably, we've done the modern day, we've done the Filthy Four. That's probably a nice positive note to end on. So thanks so much for joining us, Nick.
Yeah, thank you, mate.
Absolute pleasure. It's been as fun for me as anything I've done before. So it's incredibly enjoyable. You guys know that I'm a huge fan of podcasts. So take a walk down memory lane I think I told my wife, I'm chatting with some guys on my favourite podcast to talk about the 95 Canterbury side. Well, that sounds like it'll be fun for you. I'm just like, you know what? It sure is. So thanks very much for having me, guys. It's been a really fun hour.
No worries. So Making the Nut from the Couch, a must read every week. What else have you got going on?
I write for The Guardian these days. Host a rugby league gambling podcast, The Advantage Line. Do a bit of rugby league for the Little Birdie podcast. A few betting sites out there.
Is there any gambling in rugby league?
just a little bit. And, I'm trying to make a nice niche for myself. So. I do like the Terry Lamb after his justification after he kicked that field goal to lose 12-11 to Newcastle is go, oh, I would have made someone happy at footy tab. Can you imagine someone saying that now?
All right. Well, thanks so much, Nick. This was a lot of fun. Any Dogs fan, I'm sure you'll get a lot out of this. So thank you, and we will speak to you next week.
Cheers, Nick.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.